Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness, the way we are changing as a collective society. And I think there's nothing more important than understanding the history, the historic precedents to the movement we are now in. And that's why I'm interviewing tonight Mitch Horowitz, who's written an amazing book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. And it certainly has, and this is a great historical overview of the positive thinking movement that, Mitch, it's much deeper than just positive thinking, I would say. Wouldn't you?
Yes, and you know, really, the movements and the ideas that I group under positive thinking really represent the last 150 years of our search to discover the depths and the powers within ourselves and the creative abilities of our own minds. The positive thinkers, going back, say, 150 years ago, were the first ones to ask questions about not only whether there existed a subconscious mind, but whether there are non-physical qualities to the minds. And those are some of the deepest questions that we stand in front of today.
Right. And I think this really dovetails beautifully with your previous book, Occult America, which is a really comprehensive overview of the spiritual developments that happened in this country. And so these as historical backgrounds for where we are now, give us this, what was the last thing you say? How do we go beyond the mind? Is that what you were just saying?
Well, how do we deepen our conceptions of what the mind is? You know, it's certainly something that gets us, that can get us through the day, that can help us assemble a shopping list, that can help us build a bridge or cure a disease. But I think what people who have been interested in positive thinking have been really pursuing over the past several generations, and I should say that when we refer to positive thinking, we mean the belief that thoughts are causative, that your thoughts somehow have a concrete and deeply felt experience on your day-to-day life. What people who have been interested in that idea have been pursuing is the question of whether we have an existence that goes beyond the physical, whether what you and I think actually determines what we experience in a concrete and material way. And that question, I think, is the key question of life in the 21st century, you know, the question of whether we are more than just our physical forms is as important to us right now in the year 2014 as, say, the question of evolution was to people over 100 years ago. It gives us a whole new conception of who we are. And a lot of those questions were instigated by people who were involved in mental healing, mind power, metaphysics, the things that came to be known as positive thinking. When those ideas began bubbling up in this country 150 years ago, they were radically new. The notion that there even was an unconscious mind wasn't something that people really began to come around to until the turn of the 20th century. So the positive thinkers kind of opened up a whole world of experiment that we're living within today.
Right. A couple of things come up as you talk. First of all, it seems like that has always been the search. I mean, as far as religion, are we more than just this physical being? As I mean, is there more to what is called the soul nature? And I think that's been an eternal question. I think what makes it modern is the sense that we are developing a science to trying to understand that. So, so taking those two ideas, I mean, I also have to say we don't really know what the mind is. That's also
right.
The thing.
Right.
So how do you take all that and see? Well, I mean, you've outlined a great history, but how do we take all this and move towards a new future?
Well, you made an important point. We don't really know what the mind is. We very often reference things that we all give a name to, but we don't really have a definition of what they are. You know, what is the ego? What is consciousness? What does it mean to be aware? What is observation? Who's doing the observing? We speak about the mind because we understand that we all have some sort of faculty that can tell us 2 plus 2 equals 4, and we can extrapolate out from there. But all across different fields of science and psychology and research over the past 100 years or so, we find things happening that seem to result from the mind that go far beyond 2 plus 2 equals 4, what we've been taught to consider as the functions of the mind. So in placebo studies, we not only find the mind affecting the body, which we've known for a long time, but in current studies in brain biology, we find that our thoughts actually not only determine, but can redetermine the biology of our brains. If we sustainably and continually redirect our thoughts in certain ways, brain scans show again and again that eventually the neural pathways and the actual biologic makeup of our brain, particularly in connection with how electrical pathways and circuits establish grooves and patterns and thought habits in our brains, there's a physical correlate to all of this, it changes as our thoughts change. So this is being used, for example, to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder. If we can sustainably redirect our thoughts away from ritualistic behaviors or destructive behaviors, part of the recovery process that occurs is that our brains actually change too. This is mind over matter in the most literal sense. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, we could talk further about the findings that have been coming out of 80 years of quantum physics experiments where subatomic particles change location, change direction, change form based on the presence of an observer and a decision whether to look in a certain place or not look in a certain place. We grow up learning that the mind is not supposed to affect matter. The mind is not supposed to affect concrete experience. The mind is supposed to perform logic and analysis. And yet we keep getting these glimpses, almost as if we're walking into a room and flicking on the lights and we see somebody running out of the room and we just get a glimpse of them. We're getting these glimpses across various fields of research that the mind does things that we were taught as kids it's not supposed to do, that it's more than just a tool of logic. It's a tool that also seems, in certain settings that we're able to observe, to determine reality. And that puts us in front of the key mystery of the 21st century. And I tell you, you know, people make fun of positive thinking because they think, well, you know, it sounds superficial, soft-headed, you know, the idea that changing my thoughts will change my life. But positive thinking for 150 years has been on the scent trail of something that we're only just starting to discover right now in quantum physics, brain biology, psychical research, other fields of study, that the mind, against everything that we've been brought up to believe, seems to have some influence over mechanical nature. It's the mystery of our times, Alan. You know, this is something that could define our generation.
Well, it's very exciting the way you talk about it. And of course, I've been interested in this field, and my whole show, New Realities, is about investigating a new manifestation of perception, really. And, you know, people like Deepak Chopra says that we don't exist in the world. The world exists is in us. And so everything is a reflection of our inner perceptions. And, you know, we've believed in a collective reality, but that's a fiction of maybe some bigger mind. So I think what I also want to, like, so how do we understand that? I think we're evolving towards that. I think psychology, and my thesis is psychology, or what we, like you say, been taught to believe, has gotten us so far in understanding the self on a very basic level. And now we have to let those parameters go that have been qualified by a psychological paradigm to include more. And I think that's really what you lead people to towards the end of your book. Would you say that?
Yes, I think that we really have to regard ourselves with great care as experimenters. You know, we are probably in our own private lives and as a culture probing the outer edges of the laws that we grew up with. As you said, psychology has brought us to a certain point. You know, people today of every walk of life throughout the world understand that we're the product of unseen motives, hidden motives, we talk about a subconscious mind, we talk about an unconscious mind, we talk about patterns that got set in ourselves from childhood, we talk about conditioning. We realize and we recognize something that people didn't realize and recognize a little over a century ago, which was that we human beings are the product of all kinds of hidden causes and motives and conflicts that we associate with the subconscious or the unconscious. That's a precious and extraordinary insight, but it hasn't satisfied 21st century people because we keep feeling, and I think quite rightly, that there's something more. We're not just products of conditioning. I don't think anyone would rest on that conclusion today. And you were saying earlier, we don't know quite what the mind is. We don't quite know what things like temperament are. You know, we can talk about genetics. We can talk about mapping out the human genome. We can talk about studies that show certain traits that seem to be inborn in the individual. But again, it's like we're on our knees peeking through a keyhole. I can use a term like temperament, but I can't say, and no one can say, in what measure an infant is going to grow into a functioning human being based on conditioning, based on character traits, based on genetics, based on inborn qualities of temper. We don't know. We're grasping to try to understand these things. So psychology hasn't gotten us all the way there. Nothing may get us all the way there. The human mystery may ever remain a mystery. But our psychology has to open up, and its borders have to open up today, so that we can take into account the question of how our thought patterns actually determine the reality that we're going to embark on and understand every day. Not in a metaphorical sense, not in a sense, well, you know, if I have a certain attitude, that's going to color my perception. That's certainly true. But in a very concrete sense, there seems to be some influence of the mind, at least measured on a subatomic scale, at least measured on the micro scale of brain biology, at least measured in influences that have been detected in psychical research labs, where we have developed generations of concrete evidence for precognitive abilities. There's some non-physical aspect to life that we all participate in and that has an influence on our experience. The great difficulty that we face today, and this is where we can get very speculative and get kind of lost, is in trying to draw a bridge between some of that data in quantum physics labs, in brain biology, in psychical research, in some of the cognitive sciences, trying to make a leap between things that we observe on a subatomic scale and things that we experience in day-to-day life. I can't make the leap from the particle accelerator to daily mechanical existence and say that my mind determines everything I experience. There is a great mystery there. And what we need to do is be in front of that question. And we need to keep probing that question, not only in terms of the work that's being done in the sciences, but with regard to our own lives and our own experiences. Science has to let back in anecdote and testimony. People's experiences have to start to count for something.
I think that's key. People's experiences. I think what we're at, and I think your book sort of encapsulates it in sort of a historical sense, is at a crossroads of understanding perception and consciousness. We are going from thinking there actually is an objective world out there to realizing there is only a subjective reality. But we have to keep a foot in both worlds. We have to understand that this is an agreement. This understanding of what the mind is, who we think we are, is a cultural kind of conditioning. And I think this is the evolution. We're evolving the culture to see that there's more. You know, Castaneda, I'm not sure what you think of him, but his teacher said, you know, there is a world out there, but we can never know it because all we're really knowing is our perceptions of it and our conditioned perceptions. Terence McKenna says, culture is not your friend because it puts you in a box. It puts your world in a box, and all you ever know is a box. I mean, Joseph Chilton Pierce is bringing, he says, all we live is a semantic reality of the world. So there's this other force that, yes, things like quantum physics has opened us up to realizing, and I think you're touching it. You're in a sense, at the cutting edge of this new experiment of, in Western civilization, anyway. And how do we, out of this history and these questions, start to realize that, you know, you're saying, well, we don't know if the mind creates reality, but how do we redefine the mind to see that maybe if the mind does create reality, the mind is bigger than we thought it was? So that's the sort of questions I'm throwing out at you there.
Yes. You know, we're in such a stage of experimentation right now with all of this. I have a friend named Peter Park who made the suggestion to me a couple of weeks ago that maybe what we refer to sometimes as positive thinking, or the attempt to redirect our minds through visualizations, affirmations, new thought patterns, usually in the direction of attaining some goal that we want. Maybe the fact that so many people feel that they experience a result from that kind of activity, maybe that means that what's actually going on is a kind of telepathy. Maybe the brain, maybe the mind, is a kind of homing beacon that is constantly sending out communications all the time to other people, looking for people who might help us, assist us, meet us halfway, collaborate with us on something. And sometimes in this thought field that we all participate in, if there is such a thing, and I believe there is, because we've seen so many suggestions that the mind goes beyond, again, the logical 2+2=4 analysis. We've seen so many suggestions that the mind has influences beyond logic and analysis, that I think we do participate in some field of thought. Maybe when we're redirecting our thoughts this way, and from time to time, extraordinary coincidences occur, like we find exactly the person who can help us, exactly the thing that we seem to be looking for, exactly that assistance that completes a project for us at just the crucial moment. And these things feel much greater than coincidences. There's sometimes a quality of emotional relief and deliverance that we experience when we find just what we're looking for that makes the word coincidence not even fully cover the basis of what's happened to us. Maybe in those instances, there's a kind of telepathy going on. That's one possibility.
Yeah. Well, what I throw out, and you don't really, you know, in your book, you don't come to any conclusion saying this is what, I mean, you throw out a lot of questions, and I think it's great that we, you know, have the overview. But, I mean, what I would go and say, there's a sort of vibrational signature. I mean, maybe you touch on this a little bit. And so it's like I think Pythagoras even used the example, if you pluck a guitar chord here, it'll resonate with a guitar chord someone else if it's the same vibration. So vibrations, if we are a vibration, seem to attract similar vibrations. I guess that's the law of attraction, basically. But I think there's something to that. We're putting out a field, we're emanating, and we're getting back what we put out there. I mean, I think one of the examples of one of these stories, I mean, you go through so many interesting people, but it's like your life is a reflection of what you are, not what you want, I think you say in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
And so I think if we start to understand who we are as vibrational beings, does that start to kind of move us in a new – or am I like jumping off the cliff too early?
No, I don't think you're jumping off the cliff. I mean, I think that we're all working together to try to define this non-physical experience. We go through life, we experience what feel like some just extraordinary moments of coincidence and completion that seem to correspond with things that we've determined to put out there, or that seem to reflect our mental and emotive state. And we're asking ourselves, how did this happen? How did this happen? Now, it might also be fair for a listener to say to him or herself right now, well, this is wonderful, guys, but how do I access any of this? You know, how do I participate in this? And that's why I find the positive thinking movement so valuable. It's when I say the positive thinking movement, of course, you know, I'm talking about 150 years of searching that extends from the mental healing experiments that began in New England in the 1830s and today that have found expression in the work of people ranging from secular figures like Anthony Robbins to famous exponents of positive thinking like Rhonda Byrne and her movie The Secret. You know, that covers the gamut of the movement, and there's all kinds of different expressions, some greater, some lesser, that have fallen in between those bookends. But I value this culture very much because it gets people thinking about how to use their minds in practical ways. You know, what can the individual really do to try to test the parameters of his or her own mind to meet a concrete need in daily life? And, you know, I'm going to throw out just one example because it's so simple and it's so practical. It's the kind of thing that many people won't do because they think it sounds superficial or childish, but if a person tries it in a sustained way, it can be extraordinary, and that is list making. You know, one of the exercises that has run through the positive thinking culture for maybe 90 years or so has been this idea that you sit down and you make and then repeatedly refine and edit a list of your desires. What do you really, really want in life? Very simple. A person can take out a pencil and paper who's listening and begin right now. And then refine that list. Try to narrow that list down to what your real aims and goals and wishes are. And if you stick with it for a period of days, for a period of weeks, you will discover surprises because just as you were, you referenced that wonderful quote that from Dennis McKenna that culture is not our
Terrence
friend.
You know? Yeah, culture, exactly, Terrence McKenna.
And I would second that by saying that conformity is not our friend.
And absolutely, yes.
We self-conform a lot. You know, we repeat things to us all the time that we think we're supposed to say to ourselves, but we might not feel. We might want to be in the company of a whole different group of people than we're around right now. We might literally want to do a different kind of work or live in a different kind of social setting or live in a different part of the country than we live in right now. We might tell ourselves things all the time that don't represent, in fact, our deepest and most intimate desires because we think we're supposed to. People who say, I'm not interested in money, may be very interested in money. And the opposite is also true. We force ourselves into these boxes of conformity with a lot of help from the culture, with a lot of help from what we think are other people's expectations. And this kind of list-making exercise that I'm talking about, although the act itself is very simple, the revelations that it can bring to you as an individual become not so simple if you stick with it for a really, really long time. Sometimes I challenge people with a certain story. Imagine if a genie came to you and said, I'm prepared to grant you a wish, but there's only one catch. You have to tell me the absolute truth of what you really want, and if you don't, you'll lose everything. So, you know,
right. Well, let's break that down. No, I think it's good, and I've done it. I've made lists. I mean, as part of a mystery school, and it works. But if we can just, like, play a little bit and experiment and just why and how does that work? So I make a list of everything I really want, like a partner, a job. And and I focus on that list every night when I'm going to sleep, when you're in a hypnagogic state, like somehow something expands a little more. Now, and then suddenly these things show up. Now, why and how do you think that works? Because it does work, but what is the science behind it?
I'll venture two possibilities. Yeah. The first is, on a psychological level, your thoughts need to be emotionalized. Having a thought that's not convincing to you is not going to be convincing in any other way or through any other agency, either to other people or on some greater scale. Getting down a list of what you want not only brings you clarity, but it brings you emotional conviction behind your thoughts. And when you've reached that place of emotional conviction behind your thoughts and a realistic and mature sense of self, it's also very important that your desires, I think, have to be in some congruity with your own abilities. It doesn't do any good to sit around imagining that you're going to be an astronaut if you have no experience with flight. I think that just becomes a depleting fantasy.
Right.
If you have emotional conviction behind your thought, if your lists of desires are in some realistic congruity with your own abilities, then something seems to happen, and it brings us to the threshold of your question. What's the science behind this? Why does that seem to influence some agency that helps to bring about the actual thing that we're thinking of? And Alan, if I had an answer to that question, I would not withhold it. That puts us in front of an extraordinary, extraordinary mystery. And I don't know what that something extra is that emotionalized, self-congruent thought seems to bring into play. But that is where not only personal testimony suggests to us that the mind is bringing us something greater than logic and analysis. That is where we start to come into these questions of observation actually changing the nature of matter on a subatomic scale. And we have to ask ourselves, if that's happening on a subatomic scale, can that be happening in the above board macro mechanical world that we live in? And why don't we see it more often? Now, some quantum physicists have theorized that there's a phenomenon going on in our lives called information leakage, that when we look at something very, very much up close, as if it's under a microscope, so to speak, we see all kinds of dynamic things going on. When we pull back and we experience reality with our normal physical senses, as you and I do in the workaday mechanical world, there's an information leakage going on. We lose vividness. We lose fineness of observation. We lose a probing sense of the dynamics that are really happening when you look at something under a microscope, so to speak, or when you measure something with an infinitesimally accurate degree. So the things that are happening in the micro world, apropos of observation, may be happening in some fashion in the mechanical world that we live in, but we don't have the sensory data to understand it. That's why these things become stories. They become anecdote. They become testimony. But those stories and anecdotes and testimony are very precious because they are kind of like this little path of pebbles that might help lead us closer to your very pertinent question, which is, what is the science behind the mind actually serving as an agency of creation? Because that's really what we're asking. And that is a vast, vast mystery. I attempt in the book to come up with certain possibilities as to what's going on. One of them is the possibility of telepathy that I was just mentioning. But it's unquestionable that over the course of a sensitive lifetime, you can track some of these influences. And we have to keep digging and we have to keep experimenting, and our own testimony and life experiences are going to be a vital part of assembling that puzzle.
Well, I think you've put it very well, and I think the fact that the human being is part of a mystery. We can reach for the horizon, but the mystery that we are and the mystery that we are surrounded in is ongoing and forever an expanding question, and yet we can recognize patterns of awareness, and we can grow, and there probably are masters who can totally manipulate reality. I know there are levels of conscious beings that have transcended this realm and manifest. I mean, at least that's my suspicion, but you know, I think we have to realize what we are calling science is something else, and the limitation of the human being. I mean, I'll take your story exactly in the book where your teacher, Gurdjieff teacher, told you to go out and find these buckets and what, pink heart-shaped buckets, you know,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, where are you going to find that? And well, you tell the story. It's your story. But,
well,
you know.
A teacher of mine, a very dear man who I loved very much, he liked giving me and some of my friends and colleagues these so-called impossible tasks to perform, and he directed me at one point to find basically pink heart-shaped buckets. And if I couldn't find pink heart-shaped buckets, these were for a camping trip, I was to find ordinary red plastic buckets. And the weird thing is, I looked around. I looked at all the Bed Bath and Hardware stores I could find in Manhattan. Looked and looked and looked. I could find nothing of the sort. Absolutely nothing of the sort. And I looked exhaustively. And at one point, I had concluded that I was going to have to call my teacher and tell him, look, I tried to find these pink heart-shaped buckets, but I failed. I've looked to the point of annoying everyone around me. I've been exhaustive, and I'm sorry, but I've come up short. And I was about to make this call to him on my cell phone. This was a few years ago. Just as I was standing outside of this kind of nothing, dingy neighborhood grocery store on the east side of Manhattan where I live. And something told me, you know, don't make the call right now. Just wait. Just stop. And so I put my phone away, and I went inside the store and went to the back of the store to the frozen foods section to run an errand. Right there, in the middle of the frozen food section, where I had never seen any such object before, was a brand new stack of gleaming pink heart-shaped buckets, exactly what I had been instructed to look for and exactly what I had come up short in finding in an exhaustive search right there. And I couldn't believe it. And I grabbed a stock boy and I said, can you tell me, I'm colorblind, I told him, can you tell me, please, what color those buckets are? And so, of course, he looks at me like I'm a lunatic. And he says, they're pink. They just came in. And I'm just standing there absolutely astounded. And I went back to my teacher and to some of my friends in this organization, and these are hard-headed people. These are not people who nurse fantasies. And I told them what happened, and we could all just look at one another and shake our heads. Something happened. This was an extraordinary event that no actuarial table, no statistical table, could ever fully capture, because not only did it seem to me the odds were very low of ever finding these buckets, and lower still of finding them in this grungy, nothing neighborhood grocery store, but no statistic could ever capture what the experience meant to me mm-hmm. emotionally. And people very often find that when their mind goes in search of something, and they seem to hit dead ends everywhere, and then suddenly, almost as if it's lawful, they find exactly the thing they're looking for, sometimes in the most unlikely place. No statistician can ever measure how that feels emotionally, what that means to a person emotionally. And you feel at that moment that you are participating in something that's greater than the ordinary physical, logical world that we're brought up in. So that was one of the stories of my own testimony that I share in the book.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's something in that story that is the essence, not just of positive thinking, but the essence of who I think we are as human beings. There's something that told you not to make that call.
Yes.
That is coming from beyond your personality. You see, if we look at the world, this is just my theory, in terms of personality and what we want, and we're pushing for manifestation, then we're just going to be stuck with a very mundane reality. But if we start to listen to these other aspects of ourselves, and you did listen, and you were in a way guided by a higher part of you that knew to be standing on that corner at this time, and to go into that store. I mean, there's a guidance of let's say your God force, this is my theory, directing the action when we let go of the personality, and we come into this alignment of a higher power. I mean, that's the sort of term you use. And I think, you know, Mary Baker Eddy and a lot of those people who've used that term, higher power, meant just that. They meant there's an alignment that transcends the self, that actually transcends science. There's a higher science to it. But there's something in us that is purely connected to the source. And that, if we listen to it, is a collapsing of the wave function and giving us everything we ever wanted, and materializes reality according to our needs and wishes. That's
and You know, I would also add, I mean, there's so much to say about this because it's a topic that just opens up, it reopens the question of what it means to be human. You know, I mean, we used to live, mankind used to live under the notion that, you know, we were beings who existed in a religious order, and then we came to understand physical science, and we realized that there were also physical laws that we lived under, and then came the theory of evolution, and we came to feel that there was a biological ordering to life, and now we're kind of grappling to continue to close this circle. You know, we've gone from religion to physical law and science to evolution, but we're realizing that there's some other component of what it means to be human. We're not satisfied with our psychologies. We're not satisfied with the cause and effect sciences that we've been brought up on because they don't cover all the bases of human experience. Now, of course, I would say that we also do live under physical laws. We do live under laws that we don't understand. There are physical limitations in life. Mortality alone tells us that much. And I never want people to take in this material and feel, and this is a criticism that's very frequently leveled at the positive thinking movement, and it has to be taken seriously. I don't want anyone to ever feel that the individual is responsible for the great misfortunes that occur in this life, because there are, of course, people who grow up in extraordinarily difficult circumstances, facing environmental challenges, physical challenges, emotional challenges, economic challenges, which are forces. They are forces that can grind a person down.
Yeah, there are tragedies, of course. Yeah. There's tsunamis. There are things like that. Yeah, absolutely.
And those are physical laws that we live under. So I think, and one of the things I tried to come to in the last chapter of the book, is that the mind represents one agency among other agencies that we live under. If someone cuts me, I will bleed. I live under all kinds of physical laws, not all of which I understand, but which have an enormous effect on my existence, and my physical existence, one way or another, will discontinue. But the mind seems to be one agency among others that we live under. And that's extraordinary enough. That's extraordinary enough. We live in a world that's very dynamic. There are many, many laws and forces. And the job of our generation, I believe, is to try to continue to figure out this force of mind that you were just comparing to a higher power. And I think that's very intriguing, and I think that's very important, because people have been reporting these experiences for generations, since recorded time, really. And we're now at the point where we can not only record them and talk about them, but we're getting glimpses of them in the sciences. So we're trying to figure out this whole other quality of what it means to be human.
Right. I mean, what my orientation would be, instead of reaching towards that from our previous, like, known existence as physical beings, I mean, this is just the kind of throwing this out there. I would start with the miracle. I would start with the thing that happened to you when you went into that store that transcended your personality and your awareness. I would say, that's our ground zero. Let's move backwards from that point to the concrete physical reality. But let's not say that's an anomaly. Let's not say that's a strange coincidence. Let's say that is the fundamental nature of who we are, that mystery that you encountered. That is the sort of the seed for the flower that sprouts all of humanity. That's what I would say.
I think that's very interesting. I think that brings an opening. That's a very tantalizing way of looking at that. That's the baseline reality that we have to deal with, and everything else has to be explained from that point forward. I think that's very tantalizing.
Yeah. I mean, if we just play with that, then we have to redefine who we are. I mean, the part of you that sense not to call, you know, your teacher right then is the tuned in part. It's like this, what they've said, you know, throughout history, the still small voice that's directing us. And if we listen to this inner knowing, that will lead us to all the great things. But it's like filtering the noise from the signal. Lots of people who do remote viewing say that when you remote view an object, it's not what you think it is, it's what you're not thinking it is.
Yes.
And so I think and Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think that's very intriguing, what you were just describing about the remote viewers. I was just working on a project in connection with remote viewing and psychic spying. The CIA used to underwrite a psychic spying program that was discontinued in the mid-1990s by President Bill Clinton. And the experiences of some of these remote viewers were people who would go into a relaxed state and try to gain some sort of sensory perception of an object that was physically somewhere else, and at times they would come back with extraordinary data. So, you know, continue on what you were saying. You know, these people were trying to tune out everything that was static, that was noise. That's one of the points that you were making. Alan? Did I lose you? Hello? Take your time.
Oh, I lost him for a second.
Oh, okay.
Doug?
Now I'm back.
Oh, okay.
Where do you want to pick up from?
Yeah, okay. No, go ahead. Are we back on, Doug? I guess we are.
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. So you were saying, start from that part where you were looking at the remote viewing.
Yeah. I was just working on a project in connection with remote viewing for... several decades, the CIA funded a program of psychic spying where they tried to use people who had apparent psychical or clairvoyant abilities to gain information about objects or material that was sometimes halfway around the world. And some of the people who participated in this program gained incredible sensory data about things that were going on in other places, other countries, sometimes weapons facilities, sometimes the location of American hostages or prisoners. And this program was unfortunately discontinued by Bill Clinton in the mid-1990s. At that time, it was being called Operation Stargate. But, Alan, you were making the point about the experience of the remote viewers and how they try to kind of tune out static. They try to tune out background noise. And say a little bit more about that, because I think that's a very...
I actually did interview one of the founders. I interviewed, both Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff. But
great.
If you go to YouTube, have you seen my YouTube interview with Russell Targ?
No.
Okay, because on camera, he's saying, I have something in my pocket, and you can tune in and find out what's there. And he says what confuses most people is the noise of their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Interfering with the signal of what the object is. So we are constantly being broadcast this reality, but our mind tends to override this incoming reality with what we think it is. So he said to me on video, you can watch this on YouTube, is that look for the thing that's unusual. Look for the thing that comes out. That is the psychic signal that comes to you, that just comes to you, not what you expect it to be. And he says, your mind is creating the noise of expectation. But if you go beyond that, when you listen to that still small voice, the true signal of what's being sent to you arrives. And I think the best remote viewers are the ones that can clear the static of their minds and listen to the psychic signal, as Russell Targ called it. So as we tune into ourselves, into what our knowing is, people have called this knowing, then we get the signal of what our soul desires to do, the part of us that transcends the limited human being.
Yes. I tried an exercise just this week, actually, which was somewhat along those lines, and it's very simple, and anybody can do it. I called it meditative writing. It was given to me this way. A friend of mine was telling me that this was an exercise that was used in an evangelical self-help group called the Oxford Group, which was popular in this country in the early 20th century. And they were an extraordinary group, and many of their ideas fed into the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous. There were also controversies around the group, but some of their exercises were quite useful and remarkable. And one of them was this. You sit quietly in a meditative state for about 20 minutes with a pencil and paper in front of you. Just sit quietly. Quiet your mind. Allow yourself to go into a state of gentle relaxation. Sit there for these 20 minutes with a pad and pen in front of you, and just write thoughts as they come to you. You can address yourself to a certain question. There might be a problem you're trying to solve. There might be a situation where you're trying to make a decision. But just sit there. Let the mind be quiet, and let something be communicated through you, so to speak. At least that's the sensory experience that you might undergo. And again, it seems like one of these very simple exercises, almost too simple to try. Sit there quietly with a pencil and paper, you know, what extraordinary revelation could come out of that? And yet, when I sat there and actually did it, too often we'll talk about these things and not actually do them. When I sat there and actually did it, I found an opening. I was trying to understand a conflict that I was experiencing, and as I sat there quietly for those 20 minutes and allowed my mind to be quiet and did things not much different from what the remote viewers in the CIA program did. I mean, these people would take off their glasses, sit back in a chair, just relax quietly. Not much different from what the psychic Edgar Cayce did. You know, he would lay down on a couch, loosen his tie, remove his shoes. You know, he went into a very deep trance state, but we're not being asked to do that. We're just being asked in this meditative writing exercise to allow ourselves to relax, allow thoughts to flow from us onto paper that are not dictated by perceptions of what we think is already there, not dictated by expectations or by the roadmap that we have in our minds, which is really a product of conformity and preconception most of the time. The material that came out of me when I did that brief exercise this week was quite remarkable, and it gave me a little faith in something that was repeated over and over by Edgar Cayce, which is that anyone can do this. Anyone can do this.
But now, wait, it was remarkable in what, you don't have to tell me exactly or tell us what exactly it was, but remarkable in which way? Can you describe what that means?
The insights that came out of me were an opening. They weren't the same old information that I was telling myself about this conflict that I was dealing with, but they were fresh. They were generous. They were insightful. They were forgiving. They provided an answer, whereas before, all I had were a set of just repetitive thoughts going on in my mind about this problem that I was trying to deal with, and it provided an opening. It provided insight that seemed to be of a greater perspective, and it was so simply done. And that's why I was interested in your comment about kind of clearing away the static, clearing away the background noise that usually comes in the form of us telling ourselves, I already know what's there, seeing pictures or reviewing options in our minds that really are just repetitions. Allowing something fresh to come in can provide us with an opening that's very different from ordinary experience.
You see, all these examples that we're giving, I feel are, and we can talk about this on Thursday night. I'm going to be, Mitch is doing a presentation at the Meta Center in New York. That's February 27th, 2014. Meta Center is at 214 West 29th Street. This is Thursday coming up. But all these examples we're giving, I think, are redefining the mind. It's not linear thinking anymore. I mean, this is the old paradigm, and it's just being bumped up against, but the mind is something else. Who we are is something else. I mean, especially if you use those remote viewing examples where I talked to Hal Puthoff, and he said the strangest thing was where someone would go out to remote view a place, a target that was supposed to be, that wasn't actually given until after someone showed up. So there was a precognitive target. The person would show up at some location. I don't know why they were there, but that would end up being the target that someone wanted someone to come to. Do you follow that? It was like,
In other words, the remote viewers would identify a target that hadn't been selected yet, that they were having a precognition of something that no one had called attention to yet as a potential target.
Right. And someone would actually be at the, he said, they would say, okay, I found the target, and the remote viewer hadn't actually found it, or the person in the laboratory hadn't decided where the target would be until after. I mean, it was, and they weren't communicating with each other. It was sort of as if there was, if like the future was calling itself backwards in time. I'm not explaining that exactly, but there was some kind of past, present, and future dynamics that couldn't be explained in linear reality.
And That was also an observation that was made in quantum physics starting in the 1930s by the physicist Erwin Schrödinger, who came up with a thought experiment called Schrödinger's cat. And I'll talk about this Thursday night at Meta Center. It's too much detail to go into right now, but Schrödinger theorized that because subatomic particles seem to change position from being in a kind of a state of superposition where they're apparently everywhere at once and they only become localized after someone has made the decision to look. If you look at that in a certain way, and we can determine that subatomic particles exist in an infinite number of places because they create interference patterns, so we can see, in effect, where they've been, but they only get localized into one place after someone looks. I'll explain that in more detail Thursday night, but the fact is, the decision to look and the decision to look serving to actually localize a subatomic particle in one place, collapsing it, say, from a wave state into a particle state where it's localized, also, he theorized, creates a past for something. It not only creates present-day reality, but it creates a past. There's a whole variety of things that have to fall into place to accommodate for the fact that that particle is in one place. And he used this very entertaining experiment, which I'll describe on Thursday, to illustrate this. But looking not only creates a present, not only creates a future, but also creates a past, according to his experiment. And that's exactly what you were just saying, apropos of the remote viewers. You know, the person has selected a target that actually wasn't a target until what was experienced as the future. And so it's a whole basically like a whole field of events, past, present, and future, seem to get created based on the intention and the action of the remote viewer. A similar thing may be going on in quantum physics. I mean, this is where we get to the edge of how much we actually create by our thoughts.
Well, doesn't that get to really the heart of positive thinking? And even going back to some of the sayings of Jesus, think as though it actually is. I mean, that's if you live a reality in your mind as if it was actual, as if you believe, you know, you won $1 million, or maybe that, not that, maybe something like, you know, you have a new car, something concrete. If you really feel as if that's true, if that's how the particles of reality have collapsed the wave function in you, and this is the work of Joe Dispenza, if you know his work. Do you know his work, Evolve Your Brain? Oh, you would love it, because he says if you really create the neural nets in your mind that this event is real, you create a path that leads you to the present manifestation of that reality. He says it does work. You use it in your book, but it's really at the heart of the positive thinking movement. I think it's in a sense we're discussing the science now of positive thinking.
Yes, and you know, I would add two things to that example that you just cited. It's also speaks to why it's so important that our thoughts be emotionalized. We can't be thinking one thing and feeling another. It's not widely understood that our thoughts and our emotions run on different tracks, and sometimes they're very divergent from one another. And if they're in conflict, emotions in one way or another usually win. And we get swept away by emotion all the time. We see the workaday examples where we tell ourselves not to get angry, but the thought alone is not enough to keep us from getting angry. The emotions have their own lives. So these things need to be in sync, and that can be a complex process. I also think that the individual's desires need to coalesce with the individual's needs and abilities, something basic to the individual's capacities, him or herself. I think that there has to be a quality of self-inquiry, self-knowledge, self-realization, self-cognition in this whole process, so that I'm not just sitting in a chair and thinking about what I want, but my intellect, my physicality, my ability at forging relationships is also brought into play, so that my whole being in some very realistic way is brought into the actions and capacities and abilities that I'm trying to summon up, which is why working towards a goal while concurrently thinking and feeling towards a goal seems to be the magic formula, the magic key that actually gets us somewhere. An athlete has to be working every single day, but if there's a joy in that, and if there's a goal and a focus in that, the combination is absolutely extraordinary, and it goes to the heart of what I think you're describing.
Yeah, I think you would enjoy Joe Dispenza's work. I'll send you on to some of that. But it's also as simple as what this channel who I see sometimes, Bashar, you know Bashar's work?
No.
He says, if you're looking in the mirror and a person is not smiling, you don't go up to the mirror and try to make the person in the mirror smile. He says, You have to smile first, and then that is a reflection. The world reflects that.
That's
and
wonderful.
So he says, in a sense, the world is a reflection of that emotional output that we're experiencing. You know,
yes.
Angry people will find angry people to be angry at.
Yes.
That's the law of attraction, in a sense. But it's like the world is a reflection. I think emotions are really key. And I think they're key to the human experience. In a fundamental way somehow, and we're coming also, I mean, you throw out a lot of points of how the culture is changing and evolving, and I think the integration of our emotional realities and our emotional feeling essence into our physical mental being is also another level of this evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So
the discovery of a connection between not only our bodily states and our emotional states, but our emotional states and our relationships. Apropos the example you were just using about looking in the mirror, the interconnectedness of all this is extraordinary. We've only just begun to scratch the surface of that.
I know. I'll tell you my favorite joke along those lines. I mean, sort of, in the sense that our emotions are always projected onto the world. Well, there's a couple. Maybe I'll save it for Thursday night. But the one little cartoon that I saw in The New Yorker, this guy is sitting at a bar, and he's yelling at the bartender, and he says, "You have no idea who I think I am." So,
and in a way, you know, that also speaks to the conflict that we experience when we think of ourselves in a certain way and outer life seems to communicate something contrary to that. And that can be very painful for people. But that, too, can be a step in the direction of a kind of mature self-scrutiny that brings us to the question of, do we have a set of abilities, a set of capacities that seem to make us uniquely suited to a service, to a task, to filling a need that's right in front of us. And that kind of exploration is very, very important too. There's a section of the Talmud, the great Jewish compendium of wisdom, where a student asks a master, what is the proper way to live? And the master says to him, find a place where there are no men, go there, and there be a man. So coming to terms with what unique abilities we possess that can fill a certain need, that can fill a certain service, and using that in concert with all the things that you and I have just been talking about can result at moments in a remarkable self-integration so that we don't become that guy at the bar, you know, ranting and raving, you have no idea who I think I am, but there's an integration to our actions. And that's the moment, that's the sweet spot, so to speak, where we can, I think, experience that sense of higher purpose that our thoughts and our directed, emotionalized cognition can bring us to, that creates something greater than just analysis, greater than just 2 + 2 = 4. But things seem to be created from that state.
Yeah, no, that's so important. I think that is, in a way, the jewel in this book that you've written. I mean, that essence, that's where you get the sense after reading all these things and seeing all these people's stories. But the other part of that you touched on is if your reality is not what you want it to be, and I don't mean in the case of these tragedies, but just, you know, most people live a pretty normal life, then that puts us up against ourselves to see what do I need to do? What do I have to change in order to get what ultimately I want?
Yes.
And I think that's also a valuable task of a new psychological inner revolution.
Yes. You know? And not only what do I have to change to get what I want, but where are my services being summoned? Where am I being called to? You know, that's why I think it's also very important that we have a kind of ethical backbone when we're exploring all this material, so that my life doesn't just become a expression or an attempt at desire fulfillment, but I think we need to have as our companions some of the great religious texts, the Gospels, the Talmud, the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada. Some of these great expressions of the human search for the good life are so important to have as our companions on this task, because we don't just want to become agents of selfishness, agents of desire fulfillment or desire frustration. I think it's very important that we have some sense of ourselves as fulfillers of a service, people who are contributing to the net output, the net happiness, the net sustainability of human life. And that puts us on an ethical journey as well.
Well, an ethical, but also a higher level of our calling. And you do make a comment in the book about Napoleon Hill being not ethical in that sense. I mean, I'm just curious, what was your feelings about that and Napoleon Hill's sort of conflicts that he had, his morality?
Well, I admire Hill's Think and Grow Rich, and I've read Hill's Think and Grow Rich carefully many times, and I think there's wonderful ideas in that book. But I do think that when Hill was a young man, he took certain actions that were ethically objectionable to gain the favor of certain rich people around him in the part of Virginia that he lived in. He helped cover up a negligent homicide of a young black man, and in so doing, he gained the favor of some of the local big men in the coal mining town in Virginia in which he lived, and they put him in charge of a local coal mine. I don't mean to judge him for that, because the same conflicts that are in him are in me, and the same capacity for sucking up to people in power that are in him are in me. I don't put myself above him. But I do say that that is an example of how ambition itself needs to be leavened by some ethical component. And that becomes all the more important as we're dealing with these creative mind ideas, because we are very powerful regardless of what we think of ourselves. What we do does affect other people in some way or another. And we need to be very self-scrutinizing.
Well, I agree, and I mean, we should finish up, but I mean, just whole idea of ethical responsibility and fulfilling a greater destiny that is the calling of this higher being that we really are. For me, then, it's disturbing to see the films that are coming out, or at least two of them, you know, American Hustle and Wolf of Wall Street, glorifying this unethical behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, we get a thrill out of that too. You know, we derive these thrills from violence. We derive thrills from fantasies of empowerment. We like to shove other people around. We like to tell other people what to do. When we don't deal with ultimate questions of life, we feel that the life in front of us and what we're able to grasp in it is all there is. And that leads us into a place where we're just trying to shove other people around, and we all do it. You know, we all do it.
But I don't think we really. I think we're being fed by like people like Martin Scorsese's neuroses for his own power, and we're being conditioned to think that's what we like. But I don't really think it does feel good to push people. I don't really think that's who we are.
I agree. I don't think it's ultimately who we are, and there is a kind of symbiotic relationship where, you know, a Martin Scorsese or someone else will show us a grim picture of life, and there's a kind of thrill that we get from it, and whether it leaves us with a sense of deeper emptiness afterwards, we kind of keep going back because we're not educated to realize that there can be something greater than that. So, you know, it's my fault as much as it is his fault, because I run off and I see these things and I derive the same thrill from them that everybody else does. But there is a darkness at the back of it, and there's a shallowness at the back of it, and I think you're absolutely right. I think there's something that's ultimately not nourishing about it and not who we really are.
Right, and what you're pointing to, and what you just said before, is this: the service for our bigger humanity, and this passion to be something beyond the needy personality, is in a sense our ultimate destiny. I think that's what you
implied.
That's
my wish. That's my wish. Yeah. I mean, it would be it's my wish for myself, for you, for everybody listening, that we come to that sense where we don't need to participate in violence and darkness, even vicariously. We don't need to shove other people around, and we don't need to tell other people what to do or to demand that other people reflect back to us what we want to think we are in order to feel satisfied. That's a lifetime trip, and my deepest wish for myself and everyone listening is that we make progress in that direction.
Well, I think we are. I mean, thank you, Mitch, for taking all this time.
Thank you.
And so on Thursday night, we will. How do you want to approach it? I mean, what do you want to say to people as well? You know, you'll give people a sort of history, but then we'll get into sort
That's
of
right.
these.
We get together at 7, I'm going to give a quick history of the positive thinking movement, and give us a brief history of our ability to reshape our world using our minds, and then get down to some concrete ideas that tell us that this isn't just a fantasy, that our uses of our minds really make a difference, and and go through some of the evidence that we're experiencing today that that's so, go through the great mystery, and then you and I can open it up and start to talk about some of the possibilities and where we might move tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I held back some of the questions because I didn't really want to discuss them here, because I wanted to save it.
That's great. I really enjoy it. I love being, you know, it's great, Alan, because you sort of stretch me. You know, you when I go on NPR, I can hardly ever talk about quantum physics without somebody blanching, you know. But then, you know, you'll sort of stretch me, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm the other side of NPR, and they're the other side of mainstream media, really. But, you know, there's always levels. But I think talking about quantum physics on Thursday, and really... because, you know, Richard Feynman said, if you understand quantum physics, you probably don't, because...
Don't know what you're talking about, right? Perfect.
Yes, exactly. So, but it's something is true that's so confounding to our sense of reality that stretches everyone to realize that there's a truth there. There's something there.
Yes. I feel that way very deeply, very deeply.
And
Me a favor, send me a link when this is up so I can let people know about it. And are you going to be able to put, you know, the time of the MetaCenter event with the broadcast so that, you know, people are aware of it? Cool.
Yes,
cool.
I will.
Thank
I'm going to put that out there and on this link. I'll try to put it up today. And yes, for those who are listening and would like to come on Thursday, that's February 27th, 2014.
Great.
Come to the Meta Center. That's at 214 West 29th Street, New York City, on the 16th floor. It starts at 7 p.m. Mitch will do a great overview, because I've seen some of your lectures, and the history alone is inspiring. And then what we're moving towards as we search out the unknown, I think is even more exciting. So
yes.
Yeah.
That's why that final chapter of the book, for me, was the North Star. That was, you know, even though there's a lot of history in the book, that's what I was moving towards. And we have to know our history. We have to understand where we come from to know ourselves. But then we also have to stretch that boundary and that final chapter. I would not let myself just explain positive thinking as something that might have a psychological benefit, or that, you know, might be beneficial in this thing that we call the placebo effect, because I do take a metaphysical view of life, and that was one of the challenges that I made to myself as I was writing this thing, that I wouldn't let myself off the hook in the last chapter. I do believe there's a non-physical component to life, and I thought, you know, I've got to assess the positive thinking movement in those terms, because that's how it's always seen itself. I just didn't want to cop out.
No, and I'm very happy you did that, because as a historian, being metaphysically open, gives us a greater perspective. I mean, by writing the book with that chapter in mind, it's a progression towards something. So, and then, of course, the books that you bring through in your work and the importance of that education to a public that's yearning for substantiation of these realities is very important as well. So,
I appreciate that. Thank you, man. Yeah. Thank you.
I've been talking to Mitch Horowitz, who's the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Email me if you have questions or ideas, suggestions at newrealities@earthlink.net, and check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, BBS, and good night.